Our guest today is Tom Hammond, N0SS. And Tom's got an interesting background and an interesting story to tell. How are you doing today, sir?
Well, I'm doing great, Ted. Thank you very much for calling me.
I was looking over your website, which incidentally, folks, if you want to do that while you're listening, it is N0SS.net, www.N0SS.net. And it looks to me like, boy, you're just about into everything. You're into building things and projects. You are a field tester for Alcraft, and you also enjoy CW quite a little bit. So
CW is my main mode of operation. I'm probably 98% CW. I have about 5 microphones here, but about the only time they even get plugged in is if someone actually asks for a voice contact.
I had a friend of mine that I used to hang out with in Michigan. His name was DeWitt Sims. He now lives in Kentucky, and I can't think of his call right off the top of my head. But I remember being in his shack a couple times and said, we need to give so-and-so a call on 75 meters. And he'd look around the shack and say, I have to find a microphone. I don't know. Let me see if I can find a microphone, And he was totally 100% on CW all the time. And, there's a lot of folks that don't understand that. They think, how in the world would somebody, how could you be on CW all the time? But it's a different, I don't know how to describe it. I want to say it's not just a different mode. It's a whole different environment, I guess.
It is. If you stay with CW, you become, it's just like learning another language. If you learn Spanish or any other language, after you use it for a period of time, you become fairly fluent in that particular language. And once you become fluent with CW, not only will your speed increase, but your ability to really enjoy having a QSO or a contact on CW will increase significantly. And it's no longer a chore to copy to CW, because you no longer have to worry about copying a letter at a time. You're hearing words and phrases, and it's more or less just like you and me talking back and forth.
Well, I was going to say, what speed would you say that you have settled into that you're the most comfortable with?
Probably around 30 to 35 words a minute is my comfortable speed. I can copy quite a bit faster than that, but I can no longer send significantly faster than that, at least clean CW. I can send CW up to probably 40 or 45 words a minute, but it gets pretty ragged at that point.
Okay, so you copy comfortably at around 30 words is what you're saying.
I copy comfortably up to about 50, and I can copy under a little bit of duress up to about 60, but I can only send about 30 to 35.
Okay, well, I don't want to talk to you anymore.
Okay. Well, it's been nice.
you got to
remember, I've been doing this for 50, almost 52 years. Well, actually, 50, let's see, this is 51 years. So, the first several years, there were 4 of us boys, all 14 years old, who got our licenses at the same time. And the other 3 boys had a background in music. As a result, they learned Morse code quite a bit more rapidly than I did. And they kind of blew past me. In fact, because of the code requirement back in 1958, they got their licenses a couple months before I did. But regardless, they kind of blew past me, and it took me about probably 2 or 3 years to catch up and finally pass them, because I was still operating a significant amount of CW, and they'd pretty much ventured over onto sideband. And from that point on, my enjoyment of CW took off, because I was to the point, I was about 20 or 25 words a minute at that time, and I was copying words and phrases, so I didn't have to copy everything down on paper. And it was just, very enjoyable, and it was just like, as I say, just like you and me sitting here talking on the phone.
All right, I'm going to ask a question I've never asked before, and this one may be really loaded. What is the difference between the typical phone operator and a typical CW operator?
Wow.
Because I think there is a difference, but I mean, on your side of the fence, I'd like you to tell me what you observe.
I guess my big concern or my big problem would be trying to define a typical phone operator. I don't think I'd have as much trouble defining a typical CW operator, but it seems like there are an awful lot of phone operators that are into not necessarily many, many different things, but there are a lot of different facets of phone operating that different people do. Not everybody does it all, but on CW, we're kind of divided between the rag chewers, the contesters, the DXers, probably the traffic handlers, the ones that handle national traffic system traffic, and then probably the newbies who are still working on learning the Morse code and becoming proficient in it and really aren't sure exactly where they fit in. Voice operators, for the most part, not to denigrate them at all, you know, you get a microphone, you pick it up, you hit the push-to-talk button, and you are on the air, and once you overcome your mic and any mic fright you might have, you can operate phone pretty reliably and pretty competently. At which point, I think then you have to determine what it is in amateur radio on phone operation that you enjoy most, and that you tend to gravitate toward. But I think on CW it takes a period of time, measured quite often in years, to get to the point where you really feel competent in your operation and get to the point where you really want to be. There are a lot of people that probably feel competent but still would like to have their proficiency improve significantly over what they're doing now, and if they put the time in it, usually they can do it. There are some folks who have impediments to operating CW, but by and large, I've taught an awful lot of CW classes over the years, and I've only had maybe three or four students who could not learn the code. I've had a number that would not learn the code, but only a few that could not learn the code.
Well, the ones that could not learn, what did you notice? Was there something specific about them, or did they have problems?
At least a couple of them had hearing defects, which prevented them from being able to hear the code, I think, in the manner that we normally hear it. And I don't think, at least the impression I got was that hearing aids would probably not have helped them. One gentleman I taught had tinnitus very, very badly. And, of course, that's a ringing in the ears, and I think it tended to cause him to lose concentration. Copying CW is a matter of concentration, and if you break your concentration, it's pretty easy to lose track of where you are and to get confused and to become just confused to the point that it's much more difficult to do so. The others I think had concentration problems, but not necessarily due to hearing inability or due to a physical impediment. Go ahead.
My original question was the difference between the two, and I guess I was going to I'll give you my observation, and that is this: it seems to me that the CW operator is, you know, and this is probably going to upset some people. The CW operator seems to be more of a gentleman than the phone operator. At least that's what I found in behavior on the air, just listening, you know.
I think that you probably have a point to some extent there. Now, we have some very, very nice and very, very, very good phone operators. However, I think that it's kind of like when you get behind a keyboard on the internet, you can type anything with a degree of anonymity. And sometimes it seems that folks with when they get behind a microphone kind of let their alter ego take get a hold of them, and they probably say things they would not normally say to a person's face or even anywhere around that particular person. I think that's unfortunate, but I agree that it is kind of a fact of life.
Well, Well, I don't know. I mean, that's just been my, you know, anytime I've copied CW or listened to CW QSOs and go up and down the band, and this is an observation from when I was younger, it just seemed like everybody there was more ethical. I mean, they just seemed to have more consideration for each other, and there wasn't quite the... I mean, yeah, I know you'd tune up the phone band, and then there'd be, you know, guys in the middle of arguing or talking over the top of each other. And just,
oh, yeah.
You know, like, and I've never heard that kind of stuff on CW. Maybe it goes on. Maybe I've just never heard it.
It seldom goes on CW. About the only time you hear it on CW is if there's maybe a big DX pileup or something like that, and the guys are becoming impatient and very frustrated because they can't work the DX station, and they hear other people working it, and sometimes they take out their frustrations on the other guys who are still trying to hear and work the station. But by and large, I do think that the CW population, as opposed to the phone population as a whole, probably is a little more gentlemanly. But as I say, we certainly have our share of very good, very polite operators on phone as well. In fact, I think what we often see is the operators that aren't necessarily gentlemanly and polite on phone seem to make it look much worse for those that are. And I think we tend to classify them all, you know, paint them all with the same brush. Sometimes not necessarily. Sometimes I don't think they necessarily deserve it.
Well, you know, on phone, I guess I want to say that there's plenty of very courteous people. I mean, I'm not saying that phone is is a bad place to be at all. You know? No. I guess what I'm saying is that I think it's easier to act up, you know, behind a microphone than it is behind a key. You know, it's just easier to act up.
And that's true. And of course, you and generally on CW, it's harder to display your emotions. You can't. There's no way you can shout unless you turn the amplifier on. And of course, most people couldn't tell that anyway. So you don't get as much bang for your buck, if you will, when you try to be mean and evil, wicked, mean and bad and nasty on CW.
How important, let me ask you this question, how important on CW, I mean, you've come up through the ranks on this thing, how important are things like, for example, like CW filters? I see a lot of people making a big, huge deal out of whether you're using an audio filter or you're using a crystal filter. What? Give us a scoop on that.
Well, to me, you know, using a CW filter can be a big asset to your operation. Of course, it all depends on what you're trying to do. If you're just a rag chewer, and I shouldn't say just a rag chewer, but if you are a rag chewer, and you can go find someone to contact on any portion of the band, you can pretty much always find an empty spot on the band and workstations, and probably not require much, if any, audio filtering, because you can find a spot where there's no other stations operating. As a result, you have no interference. However, if you're a contester or a DXer specifically, a CW filter can be a big benefit, and it can be either an audio filter or an IF filter or both. And of course, there's some of the new audio filters that use DSP, and some of the IF filters that use DSP now are extremely, extremely good. When somebody bothers to ask me about what audio or what filter they should get for a radio, I usually try to tell them, if you're going to operate CW, you get a 450 or a 500 hertz filter. Now, they make more narrow filters. You can quite often find 200 and 250 hertz filters. But the problem with that is, if you're going to only work one station and all you want to do is pick that one station out, that filter might not be too bad. But if you're in an operation where you not only want to work and hear that one station, but also kind of want to keep track of what's going on either side of you a little bit, a slightly wider filter can be of benefit to you, particularly if you're a contester, because during a contest, very seldom do the other stations that are calling you take the time to get exactly on your frequency. As a result, they'll be off either high or low a little bit, and if you have a really, really narrow filter, like a 200 or 250 hertz filter, it doesn't take them being off frequency very much for you to completely miss their call. in which case you're actually hurting yourself. Additionally, I have some very good friends who are very good CW operators, but they have become, at least to my mind, overly dependent upon very narrow CW filters. And in doing so, I think they, you know, when they operate someone else's radio or they operate a radio that doesn't have their extremely narrow filters, they find themselves at a disadvantage. Conversely, a person who has taught themselves or accustomed themselves to using a wider filter can always use a narrow filter with quite a bit of benefit. But again, a person who has accustomed themselves to a narrow filter, it's more difficult for them to learn to tune their ears, which is that, you know, that gray matter between either side of your head, tune that portion to concentrate and to be able to mentally pick out the signal that you're looking for in the presence, possibly, of other distracting signals. So I think CW filters are extremely good, but they have to be properly used and they have to be properly selected. And again, I think sometimes people use them much more than they probably need to. As far as which one is better, I would, if I had my choice, I would originally go with an IF-based filter, because using the IF-based filter, you're actually filtering the signals out before it gets to the audio stage. If you in doing so, that will cause the that will allow the receiver not to pump up the AGC, so you don't get a lot of pumping from the AGC when you're receiving a signal using an IF filter. If you don't have a narrow IF filter and you're trying to use an audio filter, you're already pumping up that AGC, so it makes it more difficult for the audio filter to do its job.
Well, I'll tell you something. Years ago, I purchased, I remember this very well, Martin Jew's small CW filter.
Absolutely.
Little blue box. And yep. I had a general coverage receiver, which was broad as a barn door. The ham bands were, you know, a CW portion of the band was probably a quarter of a turn on the dial. I mean, it was like the whole thing would pass you by very quickly. There was no band spread much on this thing at all. And I plugged that little CW filter in, and by goodness, I'll tell you, I could narrow it down one signal at a time. Of course, you know, I'm so ADD that, you know, if there's three or four people sending at the same time, there's no chance I can concentrate on just one of them. You know, it just isn't there. But I was so amazed at that little filter. I just loved it, you know. So
it worked wonders. It was a very good filter, and it was very easy to build. If you decided to build your own, there was not much to it, but it worked extremely well.
Well, I had taken later down the road. I had a Drake. I think it was a TR4C. I started with a TR3, then got the TR4, then the TR4C. But anyways, I recall going inside the Drake, and even though I had the CW filter in the radio, I I wired this thing right into the audio line, and did an ugly side mount to the radio, so it was right there. And I was just so addicted to that little filter. Now, it would go too narrow. I mean, it would go down to the point where it was just, and it would ring real bad. Of course, you know, it was strictly audio. I know what you're talking about on the AGC, though, because if a strong signal was coming in, it would cause the signal you're listening to bob up and down and do kind of strange things. But I was just really amazed that you could do that with audio. You know, you could filter it out with audio. So, and I guess I'm just not a real discriminant CW operator, because I just thought the thing was wonderful. I don't know, but some of us have trouble concentrating, you know, like on one signal. There's three or four in there, and I know each one is on a different note. You know, everybody's slightly off, you know, and there are those people who can concentrate just strictly on that one signal, and it may be the weakest one that they're concentrating on.
Exactly.
And they can do that. And other folks like myself, we have difficulty doing that. You know,
it's one of those deals that requires practice. And I mean, there's no way to get around it. If you practice, you can develop the talent, if you will, or the knack of being able to specifically focus on a particular tone, with or without the benefit of a really narrow filter, and you can pick them out. In fact, for the last 25 years, I have been making CW CW pileup contests for the Kansas City DX Club to run at the Dayton Hamvention each year. And I've also been making them available to a number of other ham groups and ham fests and things throughout the United States, and for that matter, even a few over in Europe. But it sends two channels of call signs, no more than two at a time, and at speeds ranging anywhere from about 20 to 35 words a minute, in the presence of a little bit of background noise from 80 meters in the middle of the summer, so you get a lot of popping and crackling and things like that. And I try to simulate a real world contest where a station would call CQ, and then all of a sudden people would be answering him. And it's 100 calls, usually sent in 4.5 to 5 minutes. And of course, the idea is to try to copy as many calls as you can. And there's no filtering on this one, so the guys that take the competition and take the pile up have to do it, you know, with the knowledge that all they're going to have to use their ears and their powers of concentration to concentrate on the call they're looking for. And we have we regularly have operators copy 50 to 60% of the call signs. So you know, it can be done, but again, you have to develop the knack to do it.
It operates 20 through 10 meters. It's stealth. It will keep up with any three-element beam and any vertical that you have on your property. But if you can't have a three-element beam or a vertical on your property, you can still have a TW2010. It is stealth. It disappears. We tried to take pictures of it, and we had to move the thing around because it hides so well. There is no compromise in performance with this antenna. And it's portable. You can take it with you on vacation. It's quite unique. They make several flavors of this antenna, however. If you want to operate 80, 40, 60, 30-meter band, it's all there. Go to their website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com. And check out the special pricing right now. H1N1, if you haven't given it much thought, you need to start now. Go to h1n1kits.us. That's h1n1kits.us. Look at the menu and go to H1N1 Flu Tracker Map USA. You can see exactly where the H1N1 virus is breaking out. It may be in your community already. You can order the Flu Blocker Influenza Kits today. They contain all the necessary personal protection equipment to help guard against the spread of the influenza virus within your work, home, and school environment. These kits contain fever strips, a protective N95 mask, disinfectant surface wipe, antimicrobial hand wipes, and a tissue pack. The H1N1 virus is here, so don't delay. Order your kits today at h1n1kits.us. That's h1n1kits.
If you're the decision maker for any form of outdoor lighting, you're going to want to listen to this. The Light Pack Systems induction lights, manufactured in the USA by a severely disabled workforce, uses a unique physical principle of light generation. This lamp system is therefore classified in a new family of sources, the Light Pack induction lamp systems. Light Pack induction lighting is a breakthrough for professional, general, and special lighting applications, not only because of its high luminescence and efficiency, but especially because of its unprecedented lifetime. System lifetime is rated at 100,000 hours, or about 20 years, based on 5,000 burning hours per year. With a failure rate of less than 10%, with this unmatched durability, LightPack offers substantial savings in direct maintenance costs as well as indirect costs. Induction lighting is relatively new in the United States, but it's proven technology developed in Europe over 20 years ago. Therefore, claims of durability is based on real-world empirical data, as opposed to estimated design life provided by competitive lighting technologies such as LED. LightPack Systems was founded on the principles of green solutions for modern lighting through strong partnerships with the U.S. military, the University of Central Florida, and several national energy service companies. LightPack offers lighting solutions that provide a better quality of light with a 66% energy savings. also lasting up to 5 times longer than standard lighting options. LightPak's quality shines through with their standard 10-year warranty on all products. Call today for your free demonstration. Go to their website, LightPakSystems.com. That's LightPakSystems.com, spelled LightPakSystems.
LightPakSystems.com. Are you needing a place to put up a website? Have you looked around? You want to do something that's easy, that's simple, and very, very inexpensive, but yet looks professional? Are you having troubles with your computer? Do you need some tech support help? Are you tired of being connected to India every time you pick up the telephone to get some help on a machine or on a website? The people to call is tux-support.com. That's tux-support.com. T-U-X, like tuxedo, dash support, the word support, .com. These are the people to call. They can get you going. It won't cost you an arm and a leg. You can afford to work with these folks. They're professionals. They answer in plain English, and they can help you do things from a very, very basic, simple standpoint. If you have something that you want to do that's a complex project, well, they can handle that as well. But if you're like I am, when you're trying to put something up on the web or you need help with a computer, you really want somebody that speaks English. And you want it to be simple, and you don't want to have to pay an arm and a leg for it. And you want to deal with some good folks. Go to their website, tux-support.com. That's tux-support.com. Here at QSO, we've got something new, and that's a prize closet. And we are in the process of filling that prize closet up. And we're going to be telling you on the air some of the items that we've got in the prize closet. If you'd like to win some of these things, we'd love to see you do that. But what you've got to do is send us an email. Go up to the website, tedrandall.com or qsoradioshow.com. And when you go to that website, just simply send us an email. Say hello, tell us where you're listening, how the signal's coming in. If you're listening by podcast, tell us how you have joined this radio show. And then put a little note in there that says, I want to win. And we'll put your name in the hat, and we will have a drawing twice a month, and we're going to be giving away what's in our prize closet. Now, I can't tell you everything that's in there so far, but we'll be posting those items up on the website, and we'll be telling you about them on the air, but don't miss out. Send us an email and put in that email, I want to win. And let's see who the lucky winners will be.
Well, you know, I was going to say, with the way that you're approaching it and the way, I guess I want to say, we've gone basically to no-code licenses, I've heard a lot of guys come on and say, boy, I really would like to get my code speed up. And they run around with the CDs in their vehicles and stuff like that, and they're listening. What do you say? I mean, what, if somebody says, hey, you know, I want to get more proficient at this because I can't really enjoy it because I'm too slow. How do they go from, you know, from 10 miles an hour to 60 miles an hour? What takes them there the best route, I guess I want to say?
The way I did it, and unfortunately it took me a couple years to, it took me probably 4 or 5 years, I guess, so over the time to do it. But I forced myself to get on and to work the stations that were sending at a speed that would push me just a little bit. In other words, if I was able to copy 25 words a minute, I'd try to find the guys that were sending 25 to 30 words a minute, or maybe even a little bit faster. And quite often I would tell them, look, you know, I'm working on getting my code up here, so please send a little faster. Don't expect me to send any faster, but if you will, send a little faster so I can push myself. Additionally, I tried to get active in as many of the domestic CW contests as possible, because that will force you to copy the higher code speeds, the higher speed code. And it could be anywhere from 20 to 35 words a minute, is the normal operating range on those contests. We've got a lot of contests, a lot of CW contests on pretty much every weekend of the year. So certainly shouldn't have a lack of contests available. A lot of them are DX contests. You can get into those. In addition to improving your CW proficiency, you get to work a lot of new countries, so your DXCC totals can go up if you're interested in things like that. That was the way I did it. Now, the way we're doing it right now is our amateur radio club sponsors an advanced CW course, which we teach every Saturday morning at 6:45 a.m. at one of the local restaurants, and it goes from 6:45 to 7:45. And then at 8 o'clock, a large number of the amateur radio operators in the area come in, and we have breakfast. We eat from 8 to 9, and then starting at 9 o'clock, we have a beginning CW class that starts and runs from 9 to 10. And we accept new licensees and anyone who wants to learn CW in the beginning course, and then once we get them up to about 15 to 18 words a minute, we'll move them over to the advanced course and try to take them from there up to 25 or 30 words a minute. And that's a good way to do it. If you can find, it'd be great if you can find somebody in your amateur radio club or in your area who is a good CW operator and who's willing to work with you. Most CW operators would, do handsprings if somebody said, "Hey, will you help me learn to be a good CW operator and learn to do CW better?" And if you can get somebody that will do that for you, get them to take you under their wing and work with you and get you on the air. The important thing though is get on the air. Your code speed, you can get your code speed up and operating much more reliably with a higher degree of proficiency if you do it on the air rather than trying to do it in a class or anything else. Doing it on the air is by far the most efficient way.
What about doing things like copying W1AW, the bulletins, and all that sort of thing?
Copying W1AW is great, but again, it only requires you to copy, and you also need to learn to send. When we teach our classes, we teach our students to copy first, and then we teach them to send. And I still think that's probably the best way to do it, but we're finding that we actually have a number of students now who can copy quite a bit faster than they can send. So they need remedial work, if you will, on learning to send and send cleanly. Sending code is not all that difficult. Sending good clean code is a little more difficult, and you need someone who knows what good clean code sounds like, where you can work them and get them to critically critique, if you will, you're sending and not be put off if they tell you you're making mistakes and telling you where you need to improve, because they're doing it with the intent of benefiting your abilities. But I think listening to W1AW is an excellent way of checking your code copying ability, and it's always good practice, but again, getting on the air and using it is still significantly better than just copying off the air or copying off a computer or a CD or anything else. When you get on the air, it's harder when you get a little frustrated to throw the pencil down and walk away, because you still have to tell the guy goodbye, thanks for the contact, rather than just turn off the radio and walk away.
Well, now let me ask you this question. What about sending and receiving in terms of keys and keyers and things? Do you use a straight key at all? Do you use a keyer? Somebody that's wanting to get their speed up, what do you suggest to help them send the cleanest code possible? Are the keyers really help? I mean, it seems to me that the keyers help. Well, you know what? Not as much myself, because I can do it with a straight key as well as I can with a keyer. But I notice some guys with a straight key, the length of the dits and the length of the dahs vary all over the place. And some of you are like, what was that?
Well, when we teach beginning CW, we try to teach our students to start out using a hand key. We generally try to bring in several extra hand keys and let them use them rather than requiring them to purchase one, because the intent is, or the hope is, that once they get up to about 15 or 18 words a minute, they may decide they want to switch over to an electronic keyer. But we try to teach them how to form and properly time and space their CW using a hand key. Once you learn how to generate it manually, I personally think it's a lot easier and a lot more efficient to then if you're going to switch to a bug or to an electronic heater, to make this transition, because you already know what good scent CW should sound like. And you should be able to tell whether that CW that you are generating with the other devices sounds properly spaced and properly formed. Now, when you use a hand key, again, you have to know exactly what good CW sounds like, and that's where it's always good to depend on a local amateur, rather than somebody on the air, but a local amateur to actually do some critiquing on your fist, because they can tell you much more quickly where you need to improve and what you need to change. Now, once you get to a point where sending CW with a hand key is starting to become more difficult, either because your wrist is wearing out, your fingers are wearing out, and of course that depends on how you hold your hand and how you hold your arm and your wrist. But regardless, when it becomes tiring for you to send using a straight key, then I would recommend someone switching to an electronic keyer. And there are a lot of good electronic keyers out there, many different models, many different brands, many, many different features, but a good self-completing electronic keyer. Now, a lot of the fellows use iambic keyers, and an iambic keyer is a special design circuit which allows you to, I think, for about four or five different characters in the alphabet, in the CW alphabet, Morse alphabet, to be able to complete them merely by squeezing the paddles together rather than alternating necessarily back and forth between the dit and the da paddle. I don't teach my students to use an iambic keyer in that particular mode, because my feeling is if they get to the point where they can send with an iambic paddle using the iambic mode, then if they ever go over to somebody else's house who does not have an iambic paddle, they're going to be in a world of hurt, because then they won't be able to use those same talents that they've developed with their keyer. So I try to teach them using an iambic keyer, but not using the iambic sending method. But I think that definitely using a keyer is the way to go when you get up to about 18 or 20 words a minute, if you want to continue to improve your sending ability. There are some folks who can send very good, clean CW with a straight key at speeds well above 20 words a minute, but there aren't that many of them, and it is quite a bit more difficult.
Well, I want to switch gears here real quick and, okay, and go down a different road here, because there's something I think you can really add to this. I've heard a lot of people say, especially some of the – well, I always refer to the curmudgeons, okay? The curmudgeon ham radio operators. I've heard them say, well, the days of kit building, the days of projects are over. You cannot find parts anymore, and therefore, you know, you might as well just give up and don't even try. And I don't know where this comes from. I really don't. I mean, it's like, I know it at all the ham fests, especially at Dayton, I noticed there was a lot of companies that had kits for sale, and of course once you buy a simple kit, you the bug bites you, you know, and then you start looking through you start looking for old junk to scrap for parts, so you can have a junk box, you know, and you can you can build out of the junk box. So you're into projects, and I want you to talk a little bit about that, because do you believe that the ham radio project days are over?
Oh no, I think they're going well. They may not be as big as they once were, but I think the face of amateur radio kit building has changed to some extent. We no longer have as much hollow state building. In other words, building using vacuum tubes. We have more solid state using transistors and semiconductors, and a lot of people don't like building using these small devices, and particularly now that so much of the componentry has gone to surface mount technology, and you've got devices now that you're having to solder in that are literally significantly smaller than a grain of rice. I think that puts makes it much more difficult for some people to feel confident about their abilities to build. But there are still many, many kits available, many people designing kits, particularly the QRPers. The QRP enthusiasts, in just about any QRP-based publication you can find all sorts of kits. And I mean, and using different construction methods. You can use printed circuit board. You can use point-to-point wiring, call it ugly wiring. There's a one style called Manhattan style, where you use a piece of PC board as the base of your kit, and then you punch out little pieces of printed circuit board that you glue to the board for the pads that you're going to solder the components to isolate them from the main copper ground. There's all sorts of stuff, and there are many sources for components. Probably not as many sources as there once were for as many various components, but you can still go to DigiKey and Mauser Electronics and all the various electronics vendors, and you can order parts from them without any problem. The parts are not terribly cheap, but they're not exceptionally pricey. There are a lot of people that are still designing printed circuit boards. Over the years, I've designed and sold a moderate number of small kits for various radios and stuff like that. And sometimes I'll just sell the bare board, and sometimes I'll sell a complete kit. But I don't think there's at all a dearth of kits available and kit building available. It just depends on whether you really want to build the type of kits that are being offered, and if you don't, I would challenge the person to maybe design their own, come up with something that they can do. Now, they're probably, I don't know that we'll ever see another Heath kit with the wide variety of things that they offer, but there are a number of various companies that are still making kits for amateur radios, again, particularly in the QRP market. There aren't all that many kits, transceivers and transmitters and things such as that being made for the higher power, 100 watt and above market, but there are still a couple of them, and I think they're doing very well, and they certainly have a lot of good and faithful customers.
Well, let me ask you this question: You said you've designed some kits and you've built some circuit boards and all the. Give us a rundown. What have you created? What have you sold? What have you still got for sale, kit wise?
Well, right now, I think the only kit that I am currently offering is a kit for the Elecraft K2 HF transceiver, which is designed to fit in the transceiver, and it's a small, about an inch and a half square printed circuit board that will allow the transceiver to drive an external high-power amplifier. Basically, what it does, it's the TR relay driver circuit. The K2, as it comes, does not include much of a facility for controlling off-board devices, so this is a small device that you can buy and build up and fit right in the radio, and it will give you an output to drive the TR relay on your high-power amplifier. But over the years, I've had a number of various audio amplifiers and CW tuning indicators and things such as that. And I've built a number of kits for our amateur radio club and things such as that. I'm working on a seal lead acid battery charger, trying to get that build. Our club was given 60 75 ampere hour gel cells that were taken out of a 911 call center recently, and we've taken those, and now I've got about 60 guys wanting battery chargers, so I'm trying to hurry to get a charger designed and out the door for them. A lot of different kits over the years. It's hard to, truthfully, to try to enumerate which ones they were. I haven't made a whole lot of money, but I have at least made some pocket money and tried to generate some more interest in folks for kit building.
Well, I can recall building I built a ton of Heath kits, but the very first CW transmitter I think I ever built was it was from scratch. But yeah. But friends of mine. Had the Amico, and I actually built one of the Amicos. I can't remember what the tube, because it's like two tubes in it or something like that, and that was it. Now I see those same Amico CW transmitters. If you find them on eBay, people are wanting $200-$300 for them. I think they sold for $19 or something.
It's the antique. Antique features of them now that they can have them and still make them work, and antique radio is coming back.
Well, you could build one of those things in an evening easy and have it up and running and on the air. But back then, of course, it was easy to find, a transformer. You could use something out of an old television set, and the parts were a little easier. But today, you don't need the horrendous power supplies to build a solid-state CW transmitter.
Well, you're right there. Basically, in most cases, you need a 12-volt, well-regulated power supply that will at least put out the current that the transmitter or receiver is going to require to draw. And once you get that, you're in pretty good shape. You no longer have to have the 300 volts and the high voltage and the 750 volts for the finals and the bias voltage and things such as that, which makes things a whole lot easier in the long run. Power supplies have become quite a bit easier to fabricate, design, and to use. And of course, we've got a lot of switching supplies now that are extremely lightweight that still put out the same amount of power as the heavier linear supplies, but they're significantly a lighter weight. I've got a 3-pound 12 volt 20 amp supply. That is the equivalent of my 40-pound 20 amp 12 volt linear supply. And guess which one I take when I go on vacation? The only problem with the switcher, of course, is that if it is a switching power supply, you have to kind of be aware of the fact that if it's not a really clean supply, it may put out some noise on the ham bands, and then you have to either do filtering or you have to make sure that you find a supply that's quiet. But I agree with you. Their power supplies the requirement for power supplies has been reduced significantly.
Well, in talking to some friends of mine that do project building, and I know you're into this, but they tell me that if you can find designs for these things that are pretty simple and easy to find, but you can literally go down to a Radio Shack and buy a half a dozen semiconductors, a couple of ICs or whatever, and come back, and it's very simple to assemble a CW transmitter and have it on the air in an evening with just a handful of parts.
Well, that's right. Of course, it may only be with 100 milliwatts or maybe up to 2 watts, but yes, you can certainly do that. And there, if you subscribe to any of the QRP publications, such as QRP Quarterly or any of those publications, they always have two or three or four articles on low power, easy to build CW rigs that you can find and build. And I'm not sure you could build one in an evening, but I think it wouldn't take very long, and they certainly are fun to build.
Well, I don't know because I haven't done this, but I was told that there's a couple of chips that are out there that are all that basically have most of the work done for you. You have to plug in a few external components to make them do it specifically what you want them to do. I don't know what the chips are. I know that the same holds true for some chips that are used as op amps that you can use for audio amplifiers or preamps or things like that you can assemble these little projects pretty quickly. It's not like a two-day thing, depending on how complex that you want to go with it. But I guess my point is that they are actually a little easier to work with maybe than it was when the days when we were building tube type stuff, because we had to deal with the bulky plate transformer, the filament transformer. Sometimes the transformer did both, but sometimes it didn't. Sometimes you had to have the plate transformer, and there really wasn't any. And even then, maybe the thing you were building only put out maybe 20 watts or so, or maybe even less, depending on how good you were at tuning and building. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, it certainly is a lot easier to use the building block approach now. You've got integrated, as you say, op amps that you can use for the audio amplifier. You can use them for comparators. You'll have an integrated IF amplifier, an integrated mixer, and sometimes integrated oscillators and things like that. So you can obtain those and use them as a building block rather than having to put a whole bunch of components together. You just basically drop that in and hook a few other building blocks up to it with some impedance matching and things such as that, and you're good to go.
Well, I know one fellow demonstrated he called it the 5-minute code oscillator. And he had picked up some parts. I don't know exactly what went into this thing, but he just picked up a handful of parts. Didn't look like too much anything, and he put the IC socket on this little breadboard, ran a few wires around. I think he might have had 2 resistors, 3 resistors. I don't know, a cap and something else. And in 5 minutes, he had a code practice oscillator. You know, he had from parts right straight to the speaker, you know. And I thought, well, you know, that's interesting, because that's something you couldn't do years ago with tubes. You didn't get it that quickly. You get it together pretty fast, but not that fast.
Oh, you're exactly right. I mean, just the oscillator. I mean, that he can get in a JK flip flop or something like that. A single package might take a dozen or more components if you were doing it 20 or 30 years ago.
That's true. Well, let's talk now. I want to ask a question. You're a field tester for Elecraft, and I was going to say Elecraft has emerging. You know, I mean, it's like, but we heard rumblings from them some time ago. Now you go to a Hamfest and you'll see 2 or 3 radios and people are manning a booth and ads in magazines and all that kind of thing. And everybody, I think Elecraft is still very, very new to most hams. And most hams don't know anything about it. So talk a little bit about Elecraft. If you're field testing these rigs, what's different about them, and how do they stack up with all the other transceiver manufacturers and whatnot?
Oh, golly. I hate to brag on anybody's anything, but I've got to say that I started out as a field tester with Elecraft back shortly before they actually came out with their first product, actually before it hit the market anyway, and that was their K2 transceiver. And I kind of got sucked into it, but we won't get into that. That's a long, drawn-out, sordid story based on one of my locals who kind of sucked me into it. But anyway, I think they started out with the K2, which was an HF. QRP transceiver that they eventually added a 100 watt amplifier to. If you wanted to add it, you didn't have to. You could run QRP, but it turned out that the designer is Wayne Burdick, M6KR, and between Wayne and his partner Eric Schwartz, WA6HHQ, they designed a transceiver with a receiver that was almost second to none. And then I'm talking about comparing it with the top-of-the-line amateur radio receivers. Even this little K2, which doesn't look all that impressive when you look at it in the front, but when you actually start using it, you realize how good a radio it is. And it's just that Wayne has done an exceptionally good job on the design of the circuitry for this radio. And building upon that, they came out with several other smaller QRP radios. Then they came out again, like I say, with the 100-watt amplifier. And then subsequently to that, more recently, within the last couple of years, they've come out with their K2 or K3, which is pretty much a competition-grade radio. I mean, it includes all of the features of the K2 and many, many other features. But it's a full competition-grade receiver. And we're finding that an awful lot of contesters, DXers, and just general run-of-the-mill operators are switching and purchasing the K3. We see an awful lot of K3s being purchased and don't see too many of them being sold. And a lot of the big names in amateur radio are, I've seen notices where, you know, so-and-so just purchased a K3 and somebody purchased two K3s or 3 K3s, and it's amazing. But the radios that they've come out with have done extremely well. Part of their success is the fact that they have an extremely vibrant, if you will, vibrant internet a presence on the Elecraft reflector, which is where users and purchasers and folks wishing information about the radios can go and submit questions, and we've got some very, very knowledgeable folks on the on the reflector, and they're very good about giving help. They're anxious to help these guys out. If you have a question, we've got people who will just almost break their necks trying to give you a good, viable answer. And we've got a lot of folks with very, very good technical expertise in the radios and about the radios. So even if you have a problem, the response is extremely fast and extremely competent, which is not necessarily always available on some of the other reflectors. I know that there are an awful lot of very bright folks on the other reflectors as well, but sometimes they don't seem to be a little more reticent about providing information. But Elecraft has become known for their response to their customers.
Let me say this though. You know, I'll tell you something. It is all about the relationship between the radio manufacturer and the end user. And in truth, the radio, to some degree, almost becomes secondary. And what I mean by that is, I recall the service provided by the R.L. Drake Company years ago.
Right.
And you could call on the phone. They were never rude. They were never short with you. They never treated you like you were an idiot because you didn't understand which end was which on a diode, you know? You know, I mean, I don't care how basic your understanding was. They were very, very nice folks to deal with, very, very professional.
I agree. So,
and I think what it has to do with is like you said, on the reflectors, this has to do with the end user actually falling in love with the radio and having an enthusiasm for the rig. And so you have a group of people there that are all turned on to this particular radio. They're all following it, and they're all having a good time exchanging ideas, and everything seems to be moving in a positive direction. And I think that's what you're... I wanted to say that because I remember that well years ago with the Drake Company, and I think
And I agree, absolutely. And one of the things about Elecraft is the fact that the owners of the company read the comments on the reflector very routinely, and they are very responsive to the requests from users. If a user wants a new feature, particularly with regard to this K3 that they've come out with, N6KR, Wayne Burdick is the one who develops a significant portion of the firmware for that, and they're always coming out with new updates and added features and things such as that that have been requested by their users to be added to the radio. So it's not like a lot of the radios that you see now is that here's the set of features that we're going to give you, and these are all you need, and don't bother asking us for any more because you're not going to get them. These guys are very good about being responsible to and responsive to the requests of their users. And as you say, I think that goes a long way to making the user feel much more comfortable with the radio that they have spent a significant amount of money for.
Well, you know, I'll tell you something, and I want to say this without, you know, casting any shadow on anyone. But I know one company right now in particular that has really fallen down on the job as far as dealing with customers. And, boy, they've got some folks that are just irate, you know, because we hear from them, you know. And that's really, really sad. I think sometimes companies can be there's just too much distance between them and the end user, and the end user can call and ask a question, or if a suggestion is made, you know, that's just a stupid user. What do they know? You know, if you follow what I'm saying. You know?
Oh, I agree. I agree wholeheartedly. And yes, I think I probably know which one you're referring to, because I think it's the one that I've already told some of the locals that I'll never do any business with again. But so much for that. But I agree, and I think that that response to the users and to their customers should be paramount. And I think a lot of companies have forgotten that.
Well, you know, and I'll tell you something. There's a lot of good manufacturers out there. There's a guy who's making good stuff, you know. And, of course, they say variety is the spice of life. So you have to have, you know, you have to have two or three different brands radios in the shack, you know. You've got to, you know, because every radio will have its outstanding corner, you know, something that you really, really love about it, you know.
I agree.
And then, but yet it'll fall short in some other areas. And that's just to be expected because that's just the way it is. But what I've been hearing about the Elecraft company has been really just, I mean, good stuff, you know. And I, of course, I've never turned the knob on an Elecraft. I have never heard one of their receivers. I have no knowledge of the radio, period, other than just, you know, when we go to the Ham Fest, we're on the air. So, I mean, I brush by a booth and I look, but I'll tell you, the radios, you know, they look pretty. they look pretty. You know, they look like something you'd want to have in your shack. Well, tell me a little bit now about the K3. What does the K3 have on it? Now, I know a big thing now is a lot of fellas are wanting to put HF rigs into this voice over IP mode. They want to get on. They want to be able to run the radio at home off of their notebook. How well do these things interface in that world?
To be very truthful, I'm not aware of anyone who has actually interfaced it to the internet. I'm not sure I can comment knowledgeably on that. The radio, I don't believe, was designed specifically. I know that, for instance, Tentec designed at least one of their radios specifically with that in mind. But I don't believe the K3 was designed with that. I think it probably was in the back of their mind somewhere, but I don't know that it was specifically designed for that particular feature. So I would beg your forgiveness in not providing too many comments on that, because I don't know. The radio is actually designed for user in front of the radio operation. We have had some fellows who have I think connected them up to the internet, but I don't know whether there's been that much activity with remoting the radio and being able to use the radio remotely. And I'm afraid if I made comments, I would be incorrect, and I'd hate to make a statement that wasn't accurate.
Well, you know, most of the rigs now, they will do any of the remote control stuff. In other words, if you can run Ham Radio Deluxe or whatever and actually, you know, control the radio, and a lot of radios have that feature anyways. In other words, you can do it. You can do it with a radio like the old ICOM 746, which was never designed to do that, but nonetheless,
right,
you know, it does it. Actually, I saw a fella had a Yaesu 757 GX on the air like that.
Wow, really?
Yeah, well, I don't know how he was doing it. I have no idea, because I've never done that, but I just know. I know when Bob Heil goes on the road, okay? Because he and my son Matt got together here in Nashville, and they were doing this video of Peter Frampton, and he was in the hotel room with his notebook, you know, talking on 75 meters. So, and I have no idea what kind of rig he had hooked up to that, but there's a lot of guys doing this, so. But I guess the thing of it is even if the design is specific for that, 99% of your operating is going to be from your shack, not from your notebook.
Absolutely.
So if it will accommodate that, that would be can you run like will the Elecraft see a computer and is there software you can use to control?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it will work with any of the I think pretty much any of the currently available logging software and control software. I use it on a daily basis with Ham Radio Deluxe, so I'm sure that you could use it, and you could make it interface with the internet using voice over IP and the computer control that is available from HRD and some of the other programs. It was just the fact that I was not aware of anybody that had done it and exactly how they went about it. But I'm sure that it can be done.
Well, I'm told if you can operate the radio with Ham Radio Deluxe, you're good to go, because then all you have to do is add the audio portion of it. And a lot of guys are using Skype and whatnot.
Right.
So that would be of course.
Well, it flies with HRD. I've been using it for the last year or so, and it's really great.
Well,
Simon, who wrote HRD, has just done a world of good for the HRD software with the K3. In fact, he purchased the K3 specifically for adding all the features of the K3 to his software.
Well, tell me a little bit about the K3 in terms of what it'll do and what you've noticed. I mean, you've obviously operated the K3. You've been a field tester. What do you notice about it that's radically different from other rigs in terms of its operation, its ease of operation, its you know, the receiver, the transmitter, all the and any other whistles and bells that you can think of.
Okay, well, you know, for my mind, you know, for the most part, a transmitter is a transmitter, but for most of the operation I do, most of the benefits are in the receiver. The receiver on the K3 is extremely sensitive. It's very, very quiet. It has a front end pretty much second to none. I mean, it's very, very difficult to overload. In fact, we use three K3s at our field day. In fact, I guess we use four K3s at our field day operation this year. We had a CW station, we had a sideband station, and we had a get-on-the-air station. And we also had a fourth K3 on 6 meters for VHF. But we had three 80 through 10 meter dipoles strung at about 30 feet high, end to end, with about 50 feet separating each of the ends of the antenna. And we did that with the intent of taking the benefit of the slight null off the ends of the dipole to help reduce chances of front end overload. But we had numerous times where we found at least two of the stations, and sometimes three of the all three of the HF stations operating on the same band. One on CW, two on phone, operating on the same band with virtually no front end overload. And you can't, I don't know of any other radios that you can do that with these days. Over the last 10 or 15 years, we have had a fairly wide assortment of the other brands of radios, and we were never able to even operate two stations on the band, even if one was on sideband and one was on CW, without having a significant amount of front end overload. But with the K3s and their front end, we've been able to, as I say, operate all three radios at many times on the same band without any problem. The filtering of the K3 is excellent. It uses DSP both at the IF and at the audio level. It offers filtering all the way down to 50 hertz, selectable in 50 hertz steps, and you can vary the center pass band. You can vary the upper end of the pass band or the lower end of the pass band independently, or you can lock them together so that you can shift the whole pass band up or down. However many filters you have in the radio, as you narrow the passband down, the radio will automatically select the most appropriate filter for the passband that you have chosen, so that if you have, let's say, a 2.8 KC filter, a 1.8 KC filter, both for sideband, and then a 1 KC filter and a 500 hertz filter, as you narrow down from sideband bandwidths to CW bandwidths, it will in turn select the 2.8, the 1.8, the 1 KC, and the 500 hertz filters. So you always have the optimum filter in line for the band that you wish to operate. Most of the features of the K3 are, most of the available features for the K3 are the same as you would find in most other good competition-grade radios. I mean, there's nothing that I can think of that significantly sets them apart in the number of features available, but in many cases, the features available that they do offer appear to be superior in the way they function. The K3 has an extremely good noise blanker. It has a very good noise reduction software that they've been tweaking recently in the field test venue. We've been going through regular updates on the both the noise reduction and the noise blanker, and I think they've got that really tuned down pretty tightly now. I had a chance just last week. We operated. We did an emergency preparedness exercise. And I actually operated on phone. I got to plug one of my microphones in, and the frequency that we were operating on, one of the nets that we were operating on, there was someone too tuned up frequency, but close enough in frequency that they put a fairly significant heterodyne on the operating frequency, and all I had to do was hit automatic notch, and within a matter of a few milliseconds, that tone was gone. And as this guy slew his VFO from one side of the passband to the other, the notch would follow him almost instantaneously. So it became not a problem at all. The full break-in CW on the K3 is quite good. It's probably not the best that I've ever used, but it is very close to being one of the best I've used. And I've certainly have not found it to be any detriment in my contest operating. And I do operate a moderate number of contests over the years, particularly the ARL CW sweepstakes. That's my favorite call, and you might notice that from the suffix of my call sign in 0SS. But it's just an exceptionally good, very solid, and constantly improving transceiver. And I think constantly improving is one of the operative words here, one of the operative phrases, because you don't find many transceivers on the market today that when you buy it, you still have the option or the you can look forward to knowing that the features and the function of the radio are going to continue to improve because the designers are still taking time to improve the firmware and improve the operation of the radio.
Well, you know, I guess that's the key to it. In other words, if you have two radios sitting side by side and they both have identical features, and maybe one has a slight edge over the other, the difference then becomes the people that you have to deal with in order to keep that radio running, get parts for it, service, and that sort of thing. That's where the rubber hits the road, because, you know, the competitive radio, if the service isn't there and the attention to the customer isn't there, then it doesn't matter, if that makes any sense at all, you know.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I agree wholeheartedly with you.
So, I mean, I would think that's, you know, that's really the bigger deal. It's like I said, sometimes the radio is not nearly as important as the relationship between the manufacturer and the end user.
Yeah.
And
yep.
At least that's what I found over the years, you know. So now, let me move into one slightly different direction here, and that is, tell me a little bit about your beginnings in ham radio. How did you get started in the hobby? What sparked your interest?
I think I mentioned earlier there were four of us boys. About the time we were 13 years old, we were all in junior high school, and some way or another, I'm not real sure, I think it was Western, I don't know whether you remember Western Radio, I think they were in Lincoln, Nebraska, but they used to sell rocket ship shaped crystal radios.
I remember the rocket radios very well, and you know, to this day, I've been puzzled about something. When I was a kid, I had one of those, and there was one wire that came out with an alligator clip on it, and you could walk over to an old lamp, you know, that was made out of metal,
right?
And clip onto that lamp, and all of a sudden, that rocket radio would just take right off and go. I mean,
it was the antenna. And that's actually what got us interested in ham radio, believe it or not. All four of us had spent our weekly grass cutting funds on each one of us had one of these radios in the evenings after school, after we'd done all our homework. We would all meet. We all lived very close together, but we'd meet and we'd walk around the neighborhood listening to the local broadcast station with 10 or 15 or 20 feet of wire stringing out the back behind us. With the crystal earphone stuck in our ear, tuning this radio around to see which radio stations we could hear. And I can remember if it was about 6 o'clock in the evening when we were still stumbling around the neighborhood, we used to hear a station who signed with Ignorant, Zany, and Noisy. And we didn't know what he was talking about, but we finally determined that his real call sign was K0IZN. And his name was Dell, and he lived somewhere in our hometown, which was Jefferson City, Missouri. And we found that if we shortened up the antennas, he became weaker, but if we walked in a certain direction, he became stronger. So all three of us, one evening, started walking toward the direction where he became stronger and recursively shortening the antennas as we went. And, of course, we didn't realize we were DFing the guy, but we were. And we ended up at this house that was about 4 or 5 blocks away from us and looked out the back, and there was this enormous tower in the back of the yard. And with bated breath and fluttering hearts, we went up to the front door and knocked on the door. And this very nice lady answered the door, and we identified ourselves and told them that asked if this was the house that we happened to be listening to on our crystal radios. And she said, well, probably could be, and asked us to wait. And a few minutes later, about a minute later, this older gentleman came to the door, and his name was Dell, and his call was K0IZN, and he walked us through the living room and through the kitchen out to the back to this absolutely wondrous room with all sorts of radio equipment, glowing, and I mean glowing, glowing tubes, a lot of heat, a lot of bright lights, a lot of filaments that you could see, and this enormous NC-183D, I believe, receiver, and a homebrew amplifier, and a Johnson Viking Ranger that he was driving the radio with. And he introduced us, introduced himself to us, and at that point we became mesmerized, and that's the way we got started. Dell took us under his wing, and Elmerdus at that time, I guess he delled us, if you will, but anyway, Elmerdus and got us through our novice licenses, and that's the way we all got started.
That's amazing. You know, I wondered about the little rocket radio. I mean, because other crystal radios I've built up, you had to have a ground and an antenna for the things to even work. And I've often wondered what caused that little radio to work when you would just clip it. You could clip it on the telephone dial, the little
yep.
stop thing that stopped your dial from rotating was usually silver looking. If you clipped onto that, boy, the stations would just pour in.
Well, of course, by that, you know, back then, you know, almost all electronics equipment was actually made out of real metal rather than plastic. So if you clipped onto something that looked like it was metal, chances are it was clipped onto something else that was metal, and you ended up having, I think, probably the whole telephone system as part of your antenna. But I agree. I really never understood exactly how it worked, but it worked, and it worked amazingly well.
I had one of those, and just recently I saw those on sale on eBay. I think someone is remanufacturing those things as a, you know,
oh, no
as,
kidding,
as some sort of a nostalgic thing. I've seen them from time to time on there, and although I have seen some folks post some of the originals on there where they had, you know, an original.
Uh-huh.
So that was kind of cool, you know, seeing a couple of those old rocket radios up there, you know.
And that's amazing.
I'd like to buy a few of those if I could find them. You know, they'd make great Christmas gifts. You know, to ham
sure
friends.
Would. Maybe one of your listeners out there has a real hoard of them out there that they'll give you a call and make you a wonderful price on them.
Yeah, I was always fascinated with crystal radios. Now, there was a fellow up in Dearborn, Michigan, that was building crystal radios and selling them on eBay. And boy, those were really slick.
Well, there's a Crystal Radio Society.
I've been up to their website, yes. And that's very interesting. I think the crystal radios can get really, really sophisticated. They got all kinds of, you know, link tuning and all kinds of stuff on the things, you know. And and they can get pretty selective. But I remember I had a shortwave crystal radio. And
really?
Yeah, and it was that was interesting because it would pull in a lot of more stations than you would think, especially if you had a decent antenna on it. You really could pull some stuff in.
Of course, that was back in the days of AM amateur radio, where you could actually understand what was being said.
Right. Well, what I'm talking about, though, it was a crystal radio that pulled in AM shortwave stations, international broadcast
right.
stations, and of course you could hear. I mean, it was limited. I mean, it certainly wasn't like a super heterodyne or something. But I mean, this thing, of course. The next stage beyond crystal radio was the regens, and there were people that made those things. Night Kit made something, and Heath Kit made something. Well, I don't know if Heath Kit did or not, but I know Night Kit did.
Yeah.
And you could get what was the thing they made? Was it called an ocean hopper or something? I don't know. It was a regen.
Yes, they had an ocean hopper.
And those radios were cool to play with. They really were. I mean, you'd be surprised as to what they would hear and what they could pick up, you know. So.
Right, and you could, and with the regen, of course, you could crank the regeneration up almost to the point of oscillation and really get them extremely sharp. Make the tuning extremely sharp.
So the rocket radio, allowed you to hear a ham. Now, I see, I'd never heard of anyone being able to pick up amateurs on the Rocket radio. I thought, you know, I figured it probably had a limitation to just the broadcast band.
Well, I think it was the fact that he was probably running about 500 watts and only five blocks away, and I think it. I think we'd have heard him even without any antenna, probably.
A little diode connected up to a wire and some headphones.
It was probably screaming to be relieved of having that big signal coming in.
Now you're also your wife is an amateur. How did you hook her into the hobby, or did she get into it on her own? I mean, did you coerce her, or how did you accomplish that?
Well, Jerry and I started dating, I think, when she was about 15 and I was 17. And, of course, by that time, I'd already been a ham for 3 years. So she pretty well knew what she was getting into if she hooked up with me. And we dated for 6.5 years before we got married. And, then, of course, once we got married, she knew that amateur radio was going to be part of my life. And she enjoyed being around the various hams. She thought they were good, good folks, and enjoyed being around them and talking to them. And decided that if she was going to be a good ham radio wife, she would get her license, I believe. She also wanted to, since we had two meters here in the house, she wanted to be able to respond to calls for assistance and things such as that she would hear on the two meter on the repeater. And, of course, without a license, she wasn't in a position to respond to any calls for assistance. So she got her license, and Jerry's been licensed for, probably 36, 38 years, probably 38 years at least now. We've been married 42, so I imagine she's been licensed for at least 38 years.
Wow. Well, sir, I want to thank you so much for coming on board and talking with us. I've enjoyed hearing about your CW experiences, the Elecraft company, projects, and everything that you've talked about, and especially the Rocket radio. That brings, I mean, there's just a bunch of guys out there right now that are saying, I had one of those, you know. But I want to thank you so much for coming on, and we'll have to have you back again. And, of course, as you're a field tester for Elecraft, as soon as you field test something new, we're going to have to get you back on and have you tell us all about it.
Okay, that would be great. We have a number of other field testers, so even if you can't find me, I'm sure you could, we could hook you up with somebody anyway, but I'll be glad to come back anytime. Thank you so much for inviting me. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you. In this day and time, what we don't have much of is time. And if you enjoy operating and you just don't get a chance to, you need to take a look at the Trans World Antennas, TW2010, and all the models that operate the different bands. Go to YouTube and put in Trans World Antennas and see how simple this thing is to set up. I mean, it is easy. It goes together fast. And, of course, that gives you more time to operate. You're not fussing around with an antenna. In an emergency situation, it is absolutely necessary. You need to have one of these. If not for yourself, for your club, or whoever it is that may get called out on a scene where you've got to operate and you've got to be able to set up quickly and efficiently. Go to their website, and that's transworldantennas.com. Transworldantennas.com. There's a link up there to YouTube, and you can see how quickly this antenna sets up, how easy it is to operate. Transworldantennas.com. At QSO, we've got a new prize closet, and we've got some interesting things going into that prize closet. Be sure and write us and send us that email that says, I want to win. Put that in the text somewhere in that email and go to our website, QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com, and send us an email. Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're listening, how the signal's coming in, or if you're listening by podcast. But be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because we're going to have some really, really neat things to give away. We'll be putting those things up on the website and telling you more about them on the air. Be sure and don't miss out. Send us an email and put in there, I want to win. Go to QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com or TedRandall.com, RANDALL, and we'll look for your email. Hello there.
Hello.
Is this? Am I talking to the train conductor? Can you hear me now?
Can you hear me through all the whistles of the trains going by?
I said I got the train conductor on the phone here.
Yeah. This is Bob Heil, K9EID, and I'm out here in southern Illinois at W9AIU. It's the fifth oldest amateur radio club in America.
My goodness.
And W9AIU has been doing this since 1929.
That's a long time.
And they've got two trailers here and about four or five stations and all kinds of generators and working CW, working RTTY, working phone, and having a big time.
Well, you were saying that these guys have been around since 1929.
Exactly.
What all are they involved in there?
Well, it's just across the river from St. Louis, and it's in the metro region of St. Louis, so a lot of guys that live in the metro area belong to the Egyptian Radio Club. They do all kinds of things. Of course, they do field day and lots of emergencies. They do the bike run things and helping people with all kinds of races and communications, as well as a number of them are up on the sites today helping them sandbag and giving them information and helping with the radio communications where we're having the flood disasters up the river here about 50 miles from where we are. So we've got a little bit of sparse work here at the field day site because some of the guys are up doing that emergency communications work.
Well, there.
So they do a number of things. They also have a full school and testing for people that want to become amateur radio operators, and they do that right here at the Southern Illinois University campus. And that's where we are. We're on the SIU campus in Granite City, Illinois.
Granite City. Well, you know, they've got their own real field day going on with all the emergency stuff that they're involved in.
They do. That's what field day is all about, as you well know, Ted, that we come out here, nothing is plugged into electric. You might hear the generators running in the background. I'll walk up here a little bit and let you hear some of this. The generators are giving us the power to run the transmitters. And we take them way on up the way here, so they're the noisy area. But that's the old generators running there, and then we're back down here. They've got a couple of different trailers set up with the guys inside because it's got to be quiet for them to be able to operate. Of course, every one of them's got a Heil headset on so they can hear better and not have so much outside noise, and the phase reversal on the headset is amazing because they can reverse the phase of the speakers, and that allows them to pick the signals out better. So they've all got that going on. But we're very very happy with the operation with what's going on with all the emergency stuff around here today. But field day is for us to test our own, because we're doing this to test our own stations, our own people, and equipment.
We've been broadcasting here. We're using the Finn, and we're also using the Heritage mic today. We've had guests on both mics, and they sound fantastic. What do you recommend for an operation like Field Day, where the maximum intelligibility is needed?
Well, we're talking about amateur radio, and of course the FCC dictates the fact that we'll be about 3 KCU wide, so you don't have a lot of bandwidth. Well, what we do is the microphone for that choice is a microphone that we tailor with an it actually has a labyrinth inside it, Ted. It's an amazing little piece that I designed back in 1982, and this thing tunes 10 dB spike at about 2,500 cycles. I mean, it's just in your face. Not pretty sounding, but it cuts right through, rolls everything off under 600 cycles, everything off of it about 5K, with this great big spike right in the middle of the human voice, where we need to know, what did you say, an F or an S, a P or a B, to get that articulation. Because when we're out in the emergencies, or with we're just running a contest with a lot of noise and there's a lot of stations, that guy's going to be heard first because all of his power is going to be right where the human ear wants to hear those important syllables. And that's what we've done for this industry, is create microphones that do that. We also have, of course, as you well know, microphones that work on the performance level, but for ham radio, it's a whole different ballgame because we're only dealing with 2.5 to 3 kc wide bandwidth that the FCC will dictate to us. But the important thing is to get articulation through, and then we build that in microphones that you can hold in your hand, or we build it in headsets that you can wear and have hands free, that kind of thing.
Well, now, of all the Heil models, which one is the most optimum for that sort of thing? Which one would you, if you were going to pick one today to operate Field Day, what would you pick?
Well, that, we build a number of things. That element is called an HC4, a Heil cartridge 4. That's got that big spike in it. And that HC4 we build in a headset, our ProSet 4. We build it in a microphone, which is the HM10 that has both elements in it, both that HC4 and the HC5, which is a real smooth rag-chew type thing. And we have it in our gold mine, the GM4, and all of those products have the HC4 for ultimate communications. And then they have another element that you can switch in for when you're just talking to your buddies and you don't need all that that spike and that articulate sound to cut through noise and things. But we make the HC4 into a lot of different products because we make various headsets and microphones, and the HC4 is the one to do that with.
Of all the Heil mics, which ones do you find the HC4 cartridge in?
Well, we have the HM10, our Goldmine GM4. Those are both microphones. In fact, the GM4 looks like our PR20 that you see on the stages, but has a push-to-talk switch in it, and it has both of these elements. It has the wideband element and the HC4. Then we also have the Handy Mic, and the Handy Mic 4, it's only 4 inches long. It has this element in it, and that's what we use for a hand mic. It's just wonderful for communications for ham radio.
Well, I want you to say hello to Dr. Michael Barrett sitting here next to me, and he's the fellow with the TW Antenna Company. And I don't know if you've seen the TW2010, but I know he stopped by your booth, and he picked up some microphone there. What was that you picked up, Michael?
Bob, I bought a PR-781, a boom, a cord. I got everything I needed, but I didn't get a foot switch or a hand switch, so I had to improvise. But as soon as I get on the Internet tonight, I'm going to get me a hand switch. How about that?
There you go. Well, nice to hear your voice, Michael, and appreciate you helping Ted here. Boy, what a nice thing he's got going here. This is great.
Really good. I would also tell you, Bob, I've got on a very brilliant blue and beige cap that says Heil Sound on it. And about every 30 minutes or so, 20 or 30 minutes, I'll point to that cap so Ted will get a pitch in for Heil, because you guys make great products, and I use them, and we've got a bunch of them around today, so I'm not going to take up your time, but just keep doing all that good stuff, Bob.
You should see him with the Heil hat on, the blue Heil hat with the headphones on, and sitting here in front of this Finn all lit up blue at the same time. I'm telling you what.
All right. You guys are in the thick of it there. That's great. Well, I appreciate all of that. That's great.
Well, we had a call earlier from Captain Jeff Hammer, calling from Iraq, and he was a little north of Baghdad, and those guys were set up there doing Field Day, and actually they were looking for a packet station here in the U.S., but that was a real inspiring phone call, to say the least.
Oh, isn't that great?
Hey, Bob, I gave them an antenna. You need to pick them out whatever. They were working an ICOM 7000, so whatever you got that'll work on an ICOM 7000, I'll challenge you to get the address from David and maybe send them one.
Yeah, absolutely. We send a lot of stuff like that to the guys when we know they need them, because they certainly are doing a job, and they need to have all the help that we can give them, and we can do that, certainly can.
But tell us which one works on ICOM 7000. What do you recommend?
Well, I would use what we call our Traveler. The Traveler is a headset that plugs right into the 7000 or the 706 or any of the ICOMs. The Traveler is great. You don't have to do anything. It's got a push-to-talk switch on the right on the fob that's on the wire, and you don't need anything else. Just the Traveler, Way you go. Works great.
There you go, Ted.
The station, you know, I've just lost my notes. The station that you're at right now, the group that you're at that you were talking about, why don't you recap what they're doing? And that's, I think it's W9AIU. Is that correct?
Yes. W9AIU is the Egyptian Radio Club. And they're one of the oldest radio clubs in America. They've been here going since 1929. They're just across the river from St. Louis. So they have a lot of Metro St. Louis area hams, Illinois and Missouri. But this this amateur radio club does so much, and they do a lot of emergency communications here, you know, the bike runs and stuff like that, too. A couple of the guys that should be here, they're on up the way today, helping them up in the floodplains where they're having so much problems, as we all know, with this darn flood stuff, and running some communications where they're trying to do sandbagging and all that. So they're a little bit short here today. But, hey, no problem. People will pick up and make out for it. No problem at all. But W9AIU is a well-renowned club, and we're very proud of it. It's been around doing things for a long time in amateur radio. They also have a great school where they teach and test people that want to be amateur radio operators. So we got a few new operators today. It's kind of fun. The young children that are just getting into the hobby, and this is kind of their first time to really work a lot of stations. So that's kind of fun to watch them get on and do their thing. That's what Field Day is all about. We're out here to test and see what we can do. You got to come out at 9 o'clock on Saturday morning. You got a couple of hours to put up all your antennas, start your generators. Nothing can be plugged into 110. We have to have generators, gasoline powered. You even have a bicycle down here and has a generator, and guys got to be cranking on that the pedals all the time, and they got a little QRP transmitter that bicycle power is running, and got some solar power running. So all kinds of emergency communications, and this is where we get to test it for 24 hours.
Well, you know, that's really, really encouraging when you hear about these clubs that are putting on classes and doing that sort of thing and mentoring new hams into the hobby. That's, of course, it's not only is it really needed today, but
absolutely,
it's just, you know, it's just encouraging to hear that. I enjoy actually when it came to Dayton, I enjoyed watching Gordon West with his graduation cap on and the pointer teaching his class there. That was just absolutely too cool.
And, I spend a lot of time with Gordo and Susie when Sarah and I are in our California home. We're out there about 10 days, 2 weeks a month, and we spend a lot of time with them. And last month when we were out, I got to watch him. He had 150 people in this class, and 35 of them were testing that particular day. And it's just so thrilling to watch these people, and these are not just young children. One of the guys was 81 or 82, and they passed their ham radio test, and the enthusiasm, why, it's just incredible, Ted. And Gordon West is the best at it. He is such an incredible teacher, and he has the Gordon West radio school that you can go to and learn all kinds of electronics and what you have to know to pass the FCC test, and then he and a group of the volunteer examiners give that test, and you are a ham radio operator. So Gordo does a lot of great things for this hobby. He publishes books and the tapes to learn anything. It's just really, really great.
Well, I had the chance to listen in on a couple of his CDs, and if a person is wanting to get a ticket, that has got to be the most entertaining way to possibly go. You're sitting there listening, and he's talking about something, and all of a sudden you hear this this knocking sound, and he says, "Oh, wait a minute, it's my wife Susie," and she says, "There's somebody at the door, Gordon." And he says, "Who is it?" And she says, "It's Eli the Iceman." And I mean, you want to roll in the floor, you know? I mean, it's just unbelievable. Who would
freak? Gordo. Gordo.
We
go out there on the weekends and we take a little Yaesu battery-operated transceiver out on Seal Beach and put up a little 10-foot antenna and put up a little tent. Sarah, my wife, and Susie, his wife, and Chip and his wife Janet Chico Margelli, who works for us. We go out on this beach and all afternoon. We work stations all over the world with this little antenna with ground wire put into the salt water. That makes a big difference. I have a big time with Gordo and Chip and everybody, but we get to work a lot of stations all around the country, sitting out there with a little battery-operated transmitter and just having a big time. And that's our own little field day we do at least once a month.
Well, that's very, very cool. And there was something I was going to ask you about, and that is, for folks that are just getting into to ham radio, what would you suggest? You know, maybe they've just got their general ticket and they're going to be operating HF. What route would you suggest for them to go about learning about audio and microphones and what mic is right for them and what's right for their radio? What's the source material? Where can they go for that?
Well, the ARRL has such wonderful books and all kinds of things you can do. That's the first place I would go. Look at the American Radio Relay League. They do so much in publishing all types of manuals and things to help you with. There's also a lot of stuff online that you can go look and help yourself with. But I think the main thing is to try to find a local club and join that club and get involved, because there you can find a teacher, what we call our Elmers, and people that can help you, and you can go to their house. They can come to your house. You can go to a club site like the Egyptian Radio Club have, and we can do all kinds of things to help each other. And that's really what ham radio was built on, is that structure of helping one another to learn what this great hobby is all about, because there's a lot you can do with it. You can do amateur radio television. You don't have to just talk back and forth. You can send your pictures back and forth, have your own live TV station if you want. You can run just a keyboard. If you don't want to talk, you can type on a keyboard and do it a number of ways through a digital communications. But, of course, the fun thing is just to sit and talk with your buddies around the world or around the block. It depends on what frequency you're running and what kind of antennas you have. But I think it's best, Ted, if you can find a local club. And usually there are clubs around. There's a lot of radio clubs. And again, the American Radio Relay League in Newington, Connecticut, 225 Main Street, Newington, Connecticut, 225 Main Street, Newington, Connecticut. Write them, look them up on the web, give them a call. They can help you find that club, and they can help you with any kind of material like you're looking for.
And I want to touch on just one thing here, and then Michael has a quick question for you, and that is, you know, you not only are dealing with microphones for amateur, but for the folks that may be listening right now that have an interest in the recording industry or vocal mics for vocal or picking up instruments and stuff, there's a whole line of microphones that you're into there. And tell us just a little bit about those. I know you've talked to me a number of times about, I think, the PR-40 and a PR-30 mic. And tell me a little bit about those.
Well, because of ham radio, and we have to really preface all this, because a lot of people ask me, how did you get here? I got here because of ham radio. 1956, I was licensed. And I have the same passion and the same enthusiasm today out here in this field, the WNAIU club, as I did in 56. I just love this hobby. I learned so much from it. It was practically my college education, and that's what you can do in building things and designing things and, of course, then operating it. But I got into the scene building microphones. I thought we could do better with microphones back in 1982, and hundreds of thousands of them later, it's true. We have become the largest manufacturer of microphones to the ham radio industry. Then my good buddy, WB6ACU, Joe Walsh of the Eagles. Joe and I have known each other since the James Gang day back in the late 60s. I was doing his sound then, carrying bunches of speakers around and all that. And we've been together all these years helping him do stuff. But about 3 or 4 years ago, Joe was sitting in his kitchen and said, you need to build me a better microphone for my stage. And so I did. Well, I didn't know that most of the manufacturers have moved up to Mexico and China, and the quality has died. What you and I grew up with all the great quality from the big manufacturers of microphones is gone. And that's rather sad. And so I started building things for Joe, and the next thing you know, the whole world's finding out, wait a minute, there's a new sheriff in town. There's new stuff. And I have parts built all over the world. I design them in my Illinois lab here, just across the river from St. Louis, and we assemble every microphone, test every microphone, have parts made in Malaysia, Japan, Taiwan, the UK. All these parts are shipped back into Illinois for both ham radio as well as now our Pro Line, and we assemble it all there. And we have just really come upon some real cool technologies that isn't happening because the old school boys moved off and they're not doing any R&D anymore. We have two microphones. It's just about ready to be patented, and that's an amazing thing for a dynamic microphone to have a patent, but it's all because of ham radio. And the PR40 you speak of, it starts out at 28 cycles, goes all the way out to 18K with a beautiful a peak at about 3.5K, right where your ear wants to hear it. All other microphones put a peak at 2K. Well, that's not where your brain wants to hear that. That's not natural. So then you have to equalize that out, do other things. Well, why not make the microphone to work like your ears? And one of the other things I've done all for 50 years is I play Wurlitzer theater organ in the theaters, and I learned as a child how to voice and tune big Wurlitzer pipe organs. Voicing those pipes was a monumental thing in my career. I learned to listen, Ted. And so I listen to this stuff, and I'm going, why do you have a microphone? It's got a peak down here because your ears are wanting it over here. Wouldn't it be natural to make a microphone work like your ears? And so I did. And bingo, I mean, we've got, right now, we've got about 50 major groups out on tour with our stuff. Everybody from Stevie Wonder to Gnarls Barkley, Cheryl Crow's group to ZZ Top. It's just amazing the number of groups out there that have discovered the Heil Sound microphones because they really play. And it's all because of ham radio. I learned all of that from this wonderful hobby.
Isn't that amazing? And, you know, and I want to add to this, especially for if there's younger people listening. You know, a lot of folks may, why would you want to get into ham radio? Well, you know, I have a situation here where I have two sons that wound up now as chief engineers of operations. Of course, you know about Matt, who's chief engineer for Dave Ramsey. David, my older son, he's 28. He's chief engineer for Trevecca Nazarene University here. These careers came out, sprang out of their involvement in ham radio, the extensive hands-on, I love this hobby kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so I know exactly what you're talking about. And I would have to say that because of your background, that enables you to build a much better product because you have hands-on and you have a love for it. You're not a design engineer with a college education working in a lab somewhere that's waiting for 5 o'clock to come around.
You know, it's like my good friend Joe. If you know Joe at all, you know he's the one that sings Life's Been Good. He says, you know, Bob, he says, I don't want to know about a microphone and the scope and all of this stuff you see on this chart. I don't care about that. You just plug that in, and I'll tell you if it's okay. And that's what it's all about, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
But you get all these guys that, in their little white coats and their little labs telling you, oh, I have this chamber, and I listen. Nonsense. What does it do when you got 20,000 screaming guys out here and you can't understand the words from the singer? Now let's talk about that. Did your little white room do any good? Yes, it didn't, because we don't have that problem. It's all about articulation. Where did I learn that, Ted? Learned up from ham radio, building hundreds of thousands of products a year for 25 years. I can guarantee you that the articulation, the phasing, all of the wonderful things that are involved in that microphone sitting in front of you was learned from my ham radio days. And I will never, ever lose the enthusiasm of this hobby because every time I get on the air, it's so spectacular for me. It's a piece of wire hanging in the air, and I plug a microphone into a box, and I say hello, and some guy from South Africa comes back and says, how you doing? Like, wow, that's pretty cool, isn't it?
You know, something else. The Heil Talk Box. I wanted you to mention a little bit about that because a lot of folks, I mean, that they've heard this thing. A lot of folks, have heard Peter Frampton, but they don't know there's a connection there. Tell us about that connection real quick.
Well, it actually started with Joe and Rocky Mountain Way. We were doing his James Gang, and then he started a group called Barnstorm, and we were doing all the live sound for it, and we had to figure out a way to make that crazy talk box loud, so we did. And the Heil talk box emitted from Rocky Mountain Way, and there again, the ham radio in me, and it wasn't just me. It was Joe and I, two crazy hams, went out to my plant one day and figured out how to do it, because there certainly wasn't those schematic things, you know. We just had to do it, and we did. Built the old low-pass filter, got our right driver, got all of the situations right to drive the tube. Bingo, we got the talk box. And what you do is the guitar amplifier plugs into this. It doesn't come out of a speaker. The sound comes out to this driver, which is hooked to a surgical hose, and that's up in your mouth. And as you talk or shape your words, it sounds like the guitar is talking. And then in 1974, I gave Peter Frampton one for Christmas. And I'll let you write the rest of that career. And Bon Jovi, and oh gosh, I see them all over the place today. I hear them in commercials, and just a whole ton of guys. Now we've got a lot of the guys spinning records, the DJs and the rap guys, they're using it. It's like, wow, where is this thing, where is it going next? And you know who the very, very first guy was that ever thought to do it? Was a ham radio operator, W6UK, who was, he passed away a few years ago, Alvino Ray, that played guitar for the King family.
Albie.
In 1939, he took one of those throat microphones that the World War II pilots had on their throat, and he turned it backwards, so to speak. He, instead of it coming out going into an amplifier, he put his guitar amp into those modules on his throat, and it modulated his throat. 1939, a ham radio operator. And I used to talk to him on 20 meters at least once or twice a week here some years ago, and then he died, unfortunately, and we lost another great ham, and he was in the music industry very strong. But that's how the talk box started. And it was dormant for many years. Pete Drake, right there in Nashville, picked it back up and did Forever Yours. You probably remember that song back in the 50s. And then it was kind of dormant again. And he did a few of the rock acts with it. But we picked it up with Joe and made a real strong thing out of it. And it's still there. And the very first one's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I'm very honored we're the only manufacturer that has a display in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Good grief. And everything that's in it, I stand and look at it, and I can't be more sincere, Ted Randall. When I stand in front of that display that's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I have to get pretty emotional, because every one of those products that's in there has a background, came from ham radio. Why did I learn to do that? How did I know to do that? Why did I do that? And when I think about those days of building all that stuff for these super groups back in the 70s, it was a ham radio. I'm going, wow, I could do that because of this and this because of that. And it's just every other word for me is going to be ham radio. And guys don't understand it unless you're involved in this hobby. And once you get involved, you're going to be you're going to be as enthusiastic as I am, because it's a wonderful hobby. It's a great education for children. I learned geography. I learned all kinds of things other than just electronics. I'm talking to people all over the world, and I know what direction to turn my antenna when I hear Brazil.
Well, you know, and that's another thing, too. I've heard stories about young hams that had problems with math, and when it got time for them to calculate the length of an antenna, and try to figure plate voltage and plate current and impedance and things, all of a sudden algebra came to life for them. You know, they were able then to do things that they were totally blocked before. For some reason they didn't have the incentive to do it. Now,
no.
You know, I've got to figure out how long that antenna is and what's the impedance at the feed point. Now all of a sudden the algebra is relevant, you know.
Isn't that great?
I believe Michael had a couple of questions for you here. Because I don't want to keep you on the phone. You need to get over there and have some fun.
I got to get back to operating. They're going to give me a pink ticket here if I don't get with the program.
Hey, Bob, what Ted covered pretty much what I wanted. That was one of my questions, was all the non-ham stuff and your relationship with Joe Walsh and the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. That's all great because there's a lot of hams listening to the show, the shortwave show, but there's a lot of family members and non-hams listening, and I think it's important for them to know that a little more about you, and it's not just ham radio, although there's nothing wrong with ham radio for sure. Hey, here's a question. You can have any kind of radio you want, any kind of setup. What part of ham radio do you enjoy best? I mean, what bands do you talk on? What kind of rigs? I mean, tell us a little bit when you're hamming. Tell us what Bob Hyle does when he hams.
You want to know the truth, huh?
Lay it on us, man.
I still have my 1956 Harvey Wells, my 1958 Central Electronics 20A that I built from a kit when I was 18. I still have my HT37 Hallicrafters. I still have my SX99, all this old gear that my parents bought me, and I use it on the air, on AM, on 75 meters, on 40 meters. I love that stuff. I guess it's just all the old stuff that keeps me cooking. But then, of course, I'm on all the bands. I was on 15 a while ago before I left home to come out here. I was on 17. I was on 20. And just poking around at late night, I'm on 3875 quite a bit with a bunch of guys talking. But look on 3880, 3885, 7290. Those are AM frequencies, and you'll find me a lot there with my old Tinker Toy stuff that I still keep running. And again, it's given me the passion each time I turn it on. if it breaks, we can fix it, you know. But I have a whole raft of the new transceivers. The manufacturers, of course, and I, we work very closely, and I get involved in some of the design of some of the audio front ends of these transceivers today. So I have the latest and the greatest from them that they ship into me, and I love all of that stuff, too. But I work all the bands, and of course, if you gave me one band to work, it'd have to be 6 meters. I've been on 6 meters since 1956, and I love that band. It's so wonderful when it opens. You just have so much fun. I was on there again last night. I worked about 10 or 12 stations up in the East Coast and up into Canada here from the Midwest. But just all of it. I get the thrill of all of this stuff. It's a passion that will not go away no matter what I do.
Ted tells me I can't hold the Bob Hyle press conference here, but let me ask you one more. He's holding up one finger here. These the microphones, I'm sitting in front of the Finn. It looks like a 57 Chevrolet with the blue lights on it. I'm looking across the room, and there's a Hyle Classic.
No, wrong car.
Okay.
Sitting at Joe's kitchen table one day here, I don't know, about a year and a half ago, Joe says, "You know, Bob, you need to build me a microphone. It looks like a 48 Pontiac." And so I did.
Well,
and then, I do a lot of this just for funsies for him, and then the joke's on me because it becomes a really cool product.
Okay.
And then for funsies, I put those blue LEDs in it, and ZZ Top went nuts when they saw that. So what can I tell you? It's just fun. It's really a takeoff on a 1934 Turner that they had years ago, and we classed it up a little bit, and it sounds great. Most of those old mics that, you know, that you saw, they look beautiful, but they didn't sound very good. But these all have our PR20 elements, and my gosh, I've got radio stations, I've got recording studios, I've got, of course, lots of ham radio and stages using it as an actual performance microphone. So it's kind of fun. Call it the Finn.
It's very good, Bob. That was the question. Where'd you get your inspiration? And you've let the cat out of the bag now, so we know. All right, Ted, I'm going to hush.
Bob, thank you so much for calling and for being a part of this, and for helping.
Thank you. It has to be to you to do all this. This is really fascinating to the amateur radio fraternity. We all appreciate what you're doing, and we want to try to support you in any way. And I really, really thank you for all your time. Anybody want to know more about us? It's just www.heilsound.com, H-E-I-L-S-O-U-N-D, heilsound.com. And you'll learn, like one guy said the other day, you'll learn, you go onto the pro page, and they got a lot of the early stuff in my life, said, you'll know everything about him but his skirt size. I wasn't quite sure what he meant by that, but there you are.
Well, you know, also, we're linked on the on our website. We've got the Heil logo up there. We've got links up there. Folks can get to your site from there. And I really appreciate you talking to us. Interesting story. Great. Love the stories you're telling. I'm sure everyone is sitting on the edge of their seat listening to this.
I don't know about that. Some little weirdo from Illinois. But I'm always having fun, and I appreciate you guys doing that. We're going to go back in the old trailer here and see what kind of contacts we can make from W9AIU.
All right, and check back with us in later tonight, and you can give us a report as to what's happened, and we'll go from there.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. Talk to you. Bye-bye.
Well, that's going to do it for this edition of QSO. Be sure and tune again on Thursday, same time, same station, for another QSO, as well as next week. Once again, thank you for listening to QSO.